Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Pollsters did not have a very good year in 2016. In decision after decision, pundits overlooked social and economic tensions that drove people to the polls. Those who relied on their predictions were left flabbergasted. See under Brexit, Donald Trump, the Cubs. So, considering what was at stake last year, it seems clear we desperately need to refine the tools we use to understand the world and to take stock of where we are at present. For the 7th annual Brian Lehrer Show Global Stability Summit, Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, brings us up to speed on the state of geopolitics. It is my pleasure to welcome him back to our show. Welcome back, Ian.
Hi, good to be with you.
So to remind our listeners, the Eurasia Group publishes an annual top risks report. What is that and why do you do it?
Well, we've been doing it almost since we started the firm back in 1998, and the idea is to let everyone know what our expectations are for the year ahead. We rank the risks on the basis both of the impact that they have, the likelihood, and the imminence. So you put those together, and that kind of gives you the list. And then we keep it on our website, on the homepage, all year long. And at the end of the year, we go back, we send it around again, and we say, okay, guys, let's actually remember this, and let's talk about how we did. I think it keeps our analysts sharp. Keeps them honest, allows us to continually learn from the work we're doing, and also really engages with people who, let's face it, at the end of the day, so much of the news and the analysis has become so much more polarized and politicized, and that's not what people ultimately want when they want to understand things.
Yeah, particularly if you're trying to be an actor and on the global stage.
Absolutely.
The subtitle of this year's report is the global recession, the geopolitical recession. What does this mean?
Well, we have economic recessions all the time, and we're used to them because, you know, we've lived through a few, right? So we know what a boom and bust cycle is. On average, since World War II, they've hit every 7 to 8 years. You know that geopolitics has cycles too, but because they happen much more infrequently, we don't recognize them as cycles. And this last geopolitical order, the last bust period, if you will, or boom period, was Pax Americana. It was what happened after World War II with the United States creating the international architecture with our allies, our standards, our money, our values. I mean, this was the Bretton Woods Accord on currency. It's the UN. It's the World Trade Organization, all of that, right? These organizations that sound global but are actually American in their foundation.
Right.
Well, so with 2017, it's the end of that. We can close the books on Pax Americana, and we enter into a much more destabilized interregnum period that you don't have global leadership. And people have seen it coming for a while with the weakness of Europe and the weakness of the transatlantic relationship with the rise of China. But it's really the election of Trump that puts the spike in it, because the American people have elected a president. They've made very clear that the U.S. does not want to have the burdens of global leadership. It doesn't want to be the world's policeman, doesn't want to be the architect of global trade, and doesn't want to be the exceptionalist power that promotes its values all over the world. And I think that, combined with all these other structural aspects we talked about, shows that in 2017 we're entering this profound period of geopolitical recession.
And is skeptical of the very organizations and institutions that you just ticked off that are in fact U.S.-led and created in many cases.
Absolutely. I mean, the United Nations, you know, sort of looks like an American institution if you think about where the world was in 1945. But the United States today is in a world where a lot of Americans feel like a lot of money has been spent on leadership that they haven't benefited from. A lot of corporations have acted like globalists. And Trump will say, well, these companies should be patriotic. Right? They should be focusing more on the U.S., that a U.S. multinational corporation just maximizing its profits is taking jobs and investments out of the U.S. Look at these corporate inversions, pharmaceutical companies that want to go base themselves in Ireland so they can lower their tax burden. How is that an American corporation? And I think that resonates very strongly with a lot of Americans today that voted. Of course, the other point is that a lot of Americans didn't vote at all. And for them, Washington was just become an irrelevance for them.
Listeners, what tops your list for risks for political stability, either here or around the world? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So Donald Trump, we're, as we have begun talking about, what you've called a, quote, independent America tops your list of the greatest threats to global stability. I gather that this is what you're talking about now.
Absolutely. I mean, just the idea that the United States doesn't want to play that role. And to be very clear, I'm not arguing that that means that the U.S. is no longer a superpower. I'm not arguing that the United States is suddenly going to fall apart economically at home. In fact, there's good reasons to be optimistic, at least short term, that growth in the U.S. is likely to pick up on the back of big infrastructure spending and reduction of corporate taxation and all the rest. There'll be downside from that too, but that's not the point. The point is that other countries around the world are going to be enormously unnerved by this, that American traditional alliances are going to get weaker, stress on institutions like the United Nations, the IMF is going to grow, and the trust between countries that allow you to avoid confrontation has ebbed to levels that we've not seen in decades. I mean, we've put this report out, as I said, for well over a decade. If you had asked me at any point beforehand, did I think that military confrontation between great powers was plausible, I would have said no. And I have
and now
to.
Now it is.
It's possible. Yeah, I don't think it's likely, but I can give you scenarios over North Korea, for example, between the U.S. and China. Certainly, with Iran, where we could actually see direct and significant military confrontation. That's what happens when the guardrails for the global economy and the global political system aren't there, and when the trust between those countries are eroded. That you see that when mistakes happen, they become escalated, as opposed to everyone wants to settle down, talk to each other, figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what Trump and – I think what Trump and some of his supporters would say is that the guardrails have been the problem, that the guardrails have gotten in the way of solving longstanding problems, certainly in America's interest, which would challenge this idea, right, that the guardrails are what keep us safe. Why are they wrong?
Well, in fact, you could argue that they're right if their interests are only the United States. Now, that's a shorter-term interest. I'll give you an example. If the United States doesn't want to lead on climate, right? I mean, clearly, longer-term, climate is going to be a bigger global problem, and everyone's going to get hit by that. But in the near term, unlike the economic recessions, 2008, the U.S. gets hit like everybody else. We're all coupled. Geopolitical recession, there's a lot of terrorism out there, not hitting the United States particularly. A lot of refugees out there, can't swim to the United States. We've got a big arms race going on in Asia, not in the Western Hemisphere. You've got lots of problems with border contestation all over the place in the Middle East and in Asia and in Africa, not in the United States. So the fact that the Americans are taking a more traditionally Chinese approach to foreign policy under Trump, where we're much more transactional, we don't care about the values internally to other countries or human rights, we're much less interested in providing public goods, like that actually doesn't necessarily hurt the Americans, at least in the near term. But it's going to hurt a lot of other countries. It's going to hurt a lot of other countries.
And in the near term, it may not hurt the United States. But
we'll see what happens in the long term, right? I mean, if America's able under Trump to lead by example, in other words, if the U.S. doesn't focus internationally but spends so much domestically that America as a market is seen as truly too big to fail. So in other words, if Trump isn't divisive internally but actually really is able to build up the middle class and build more legitimacy and support for U.S. Political and economic institutions, you can imagine that even if the Chinese don't like the Americans, they're going to say, well, damn, we've got to invest more because that's the place to be. I mean, ultimately, pragmatism can win. But of course, the problem is that the geopolitical backlash in other parts of the world don't tend to stay contained for long.
There's another term in your report that I want you to define. You say that Donald Trump's election has brought about a, quote, G0 world. What is that?
Well, that's a world unlike a G7 or a G20. It's one where there isn't a global leader. I mean, there's no question that if the Americans don't want to lead economically or on values or in security, there will be other countries that fill that vacuum, but no one will fill it globally. So, I mean, certainly on Russia's borders and extended borders, much more extended than the Americans would like them to be, the Russians are prepared to fill that vacuum. And, you know, in Asia, China is prepared to play a much more dramatically important security role. And even increasingly, almost globally, they'll play a bigger economic role. But when you think about what the United States has done in the Pax Americana, creating these global institutions and alliances that support them, that's going away. For the last three generations, globalization and Americanization have largely been the same thing. And U.S.-based multinational corporations have taken advantage of that, right? That's no longer going to be true. And Trump has made very clear when he got that Republican nomination in Cleveland, he said, I'm going after the globalists. Right. That's it, because that does not benefit us anymore. He represents a profound rejection of the idea that the U.S. playing a pro-globalization role redounds well to the advantage of the American citizen.
Yeah, but then he proceeded to nominate Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State based on the idea that this person who has run a global corporation can make the best deals. I mean, these seem to be these ideas, at least to me, seem to be in conflict.
They are, of course. I mean, there's no question that you look at someone like Rex Tillerson, who is an incredibly competent leader of one of the world's largest organizations, would have been a great Secretary of State under Obama because he would have been much more complementary in skill sets. Under Trump, he probably helps. It probably facilitates some of the things you wouldn't like to see from Trump, like, for example, dealing with authoritarian dictators irrespective of, you know, sort of what other values are out there, not caring as much about the transatlantic relationship. But there's no question that Tillerson supports globalization. His country, his company has benefited from that massively. When I look at Wilbur Ross, Wilbur was the Secretary of Commerce nominee. He supported the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, Trump has opposed it. Trump's killed it. It's dead. And American allies in Asia strongly oppose that. So I think it will be interesting to see to what extent, when Trump comes out on foreign policy, is he going to be delegating a lot of these things to a series of leaders that are actually much more disaggregated and different in their perspectives. I mean, you mentioned, you know, one that was really pro-globalization. I could mention a couple that really aren't. You know, it's like Mr. Flynn, who's going to be the national security advisor, or, of course, Steve Bannon, the chief strategist, who is very strongly anti-globalization, very much a populist.
I mean, does that sort of chaotic, if that's the right word, collection of advisors and cabinet members, is that in and of itself a point of instability, or is that a point of stability? I don't understand how to think about it, right? I mean, is that you have a globalist like Tillerson at State and you have Steve O'Bannon as chief of staff or as chief advisor. These really do seem diametrically opposed ideas.
They are, but I guess the point is it's not just about the United States. In other words, American leadership in the world was eroding significantly already under Bush in reaction to Afghanistan and Iraq and those failed expensive wars. It was eroding even more under Obama post-Arab Spring, also with Russia, Ukraine, failed Russia policy, and then finally TPP, which would have been a great legacy, but then which died at the end of his administration. So in other words, American foreign policy influence around the world is deteriorating significantly. The fact that Trump says America first, all you guys second, and then has a foreign policy team, some of which is very strong, some of which is very inexperienced, and which are not coherent in terms of the sorts of policies they'll support. If you're an ally of the United States, you look at America and say, I can't count on these guys the way I used to. If you're China, you say, this is a big opportunity for me to, you know, sort of spend a lot of money internationally and get a lot of these countries that used to be leaning towards the U.S. leaning towards China. So I think it really strengthens the point of the fact that independent America, a U.S. unburdened of all of these international responsibilities, is a major risk in the geopolitical environment.
Let's go to Amala in Washington Heights. Hello, Amala.
Thank you for taking my call. I did a little research about this and found that the CIA director, Brennan, at a forum, Global Security Forum in 2015, said of immediate concern, sharply reduced crop yields in multiple places could trigger a shock in food prices with devastating effect. So it's the instability caused by climate change, food insecurity, conflict, and stability was the report that came out of the center's 2016 global forecast. What do you think about that?
Ian?
Look, there's no question that you look at Trump's appointments for Department of Energy and for EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and you see that the United States is going to move in a very different direction. The Trump administration will not in any way be prioritizing that. Now, there is a lot that's happening at a decentralized level. The reason you got some support for movement on climate leadership finally in the Paris summit a year plus ago was not because Obama and Xi Jinping got their act together, but was more because people like Jack Ma, Bill Gates, Mike Bloomberg, and a bunch of mayors from India and China, from cities that you haven't heard of, decided this is too big of a deal. We need to do more ourselves. They push it. So I do think that climate science and the reality of that report that you just cited has gotten to a tipping point, that you are going to see a lot of investment around the world into alternative technologies and into a recognition that climate has to be addressed. And that's not going to be stopped by President Trump. But I would also say that the reality of climate change is that right now the countries that it's hitting are countries that are incredibly poor. Extreme climate conditions and change in food prices are going to destroy a lot of sub-Saharan African economies, and that's a very bad thing. But a lot of Americans don't care very much about that. The Europeans don't. The Chinese don't. The Japanese don't. And I say that in terms of watching their actions as opposed to what they say. I think it's quite a while before the world is going to really prioritize this in a significant way compared to other national security challenges. And I particularly say that compared to technology, because in the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to have so many American jobs going away because of automation. That will seem much more urgent and create a lot more populism for political leaders that think shorter term than climate will.
Well, I mean, and the problem being, of course, that we don't necessarily have that time on climate. The science is not something that will compromise is the scary part of all of that. So let's go to David in Williamsburg. David, welcome to WNYC.
Hi. So just real quick about that last point, I don't think that America is unaffected by climate change. I think that's kind of absurd. I mean, think of all of the uptick in natural disasters, Hurricane Katrina, sea level rise is totally going to affect us, especially in lower Manhattan. But my original point was, I think the greatest threat to stability is basically the idea that facts are now subjective. We have one man in office who basically can say, no, intelligence agencies are completely incorrect. Trust me, everyone's lying to you but me. And sadly, it's starting to work. And it's eerily familiar of some darker periods in history. That's all I have to say.
Thanks for that, David. Let's skip ahead, though, to Europe, because we're a little short on time, and I think that's a place we really need to focus on here is, Brexit. The negotiations are unfolding. Is there a way for this to unfold in a way that keeps the European attractive to current members? And is that a good or a bad thing?
If Marine Le Pen wins in France in elections coming up this year, that's going to be a pretty significant body blow to the sustainability of the EU. That would start to look like a tipping point. And that's near a coin flip, especially because of the support that she'll be getting from Putin, the support she'll be getting from the Trump administration. But for 2017, the big risk is that Angela Merkel, the chancellor, who has been the one steady leadership that in response to all the crises we've seen since the Eurozone crisis several years ago, she's been able to respond. This year, she gets a lot weaker. You've seen that in the response to refugees. You've seen it in dealing with Lufthansa, Deutsche Bank, and Volkswagen. And now you're seeing it in terms of response to terrorism. She will win re-election because the opposition is pretty weak, but her coalition is going to be a lot weaker. And when you see problems like the next Greek crisis, the next refugee crisis, dealing with the Brexit negotiations over the coming years, Merkel's ability to respond in a strong and steady way is not going to be what it was.
And so what is that going to mean? What is that going to mean if a weak Merkel? What will that mean in terms of knowing what will face refugee crises, potential economic crises? What will that actually mean that she's weaker?
It's much more every nation for itself in Europe. It means that the Schengen agreement on freedom of transit with across borders, which has allowed for a common market that functions pretty well in the EU, gets weaker. It means that Europe is going to revert more to a core of countries that are able to align and have steady values, both politically, economically, and socially. The countries countries that actually started the EU, again, assuming that Le Pen loses, as opposed to the broader EU that had aspirations to integrate to a single supranational identity, all of these countries going right down to the Middle East with Turkey, going right over to Russia with the East Europeans. That unfortunately, that if Europe was that, that was a failed experiment.
Well, we will leave it on that note. There with Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, his annual report listing the top risks for 2017. It's bound to be an interesting year.
Okay, pleasure.
Thanks for coming.